most took the path of least resistance. Once that choice had been made, violence assumed its own logic. In conditions of widespread penury, it was impossible to keep everybody alive. There simply was not enough food left in the village to provide even reliable farmers with an adequate diet, and in the climate of mass repression following the 1959 Lushan Plenum, it did not look as if the problem of shortages was about to be solved very quickly. An expedient way to increase the available food was to eliminate the weak and sick. The planned economy already reduced people to mere digits on a balance sheet, a resource to be exploited for the greater good, like coal or grain. The state was everything, the individual nothing, his worth being constantly assessed through work points and determined by the ability to move earth or plant rice. In the countryside, farmers were treated like livestock. They had to be fed, clothed, and housed, all of which came at a cost to the collective. The logical extension of these bleak calculations was to cull those judged unworthy of life. The discriminate killing of slackers, weaklings, or otherwise unproductive elements increased the overall food supply for those who contributed to the regime through their labour. Violence was one way of dealing with food shortages. Food was commonly used as a weapon. Hunger was the punishment of first resort, even more so than a beating. Li Wenming, deputy party secretary of a commune in Chuxing County, clubbed six farmers to death, but his main tool for discipline was hunger. Two recalcitrant brothers were deprived of food for a full week, and they ended up desperately foraging for roots in the forest, where they soon died of hunger. One of their wives was sick at home. She too was banned from the canteen. An entire brigade of 76 people was punished with hunger for 12 days. Many died of starvation. In Longwy commune, Guangdong, the party secretary of the commune ordered that those who did not work should not eat. Describing what happened in several counties in Sichuan, one inspector noted that commune members too sick to work are deprived of food. It hastens their deaths. In the first month, the ration was reduced to 150 grams of grain a day, then in the following month to 100 grams. In the end, those about to die were denied any food at all. In Xiangbei and Yongchuan, virtually every people's commune withholds food. In one canteen catering for 67 people, 18 died within 3 months after they were barred from the premises on grounds of sickness. Few reliable figures exist, but a team of inspectors who looked closely at a number of brigades in Zhujiang County, Sichuan, believed that 80% of those who had died of hunger had been denied food as a form of punishment. And even those who were given food in the canteen often received less than they were formally entitled to. As one farmer explained, the ladle that was dipped into the pot could read people's faces. By this, he meant a phenomenon that many interviewees recalled, namely that the man in charge of the canteen deliberately discriminated against those he considered to be bad elements. Whereas the spoon reached deep to the bottom of the pot for good workers, it merely skimmed the surface for bad elements, who were given a watery concoction. The water looked greenish and was undrinkable. Report after report alleges that the sick were also forced to come out and work in the fields. Of the 24 villagers suffering from edema who were compelled by Carter Zhao Zuodong to take part in labour, all but four died. In Xinchang commune, those who were lucky enough to be given medical treatment were driven to perform heavy labour by the local party secretary as soon as they were released from medical care. Throughout the country, those who were too ill to work were routinely cut off from the food supply, a decision easily reached by those cadres who interpreted illness as opposition to the regime. In the worst places, even those who managed to accomplish their daily task were given only a bowl of watery rice. "To each according to his needs," was the slogan heralded by model counties such as Suzhou. But all too often the reality was much closer to Lenin's dictum that he who does not work shall not eat. Some collectives even divided the local population into different groups according to their work performance, each being given a different ration. Calories were distributed according to muscle. The idea was to cut the ration from those who underperformed and use it as a bonus to encourage the better workers. It was a simple and effective system to manage scarcity, rewarding the strong at the expense of the weak. A similar system had been devised in similar circumstances when the Nazis were confronted with such food shortages that they could no longer feed their slave labourers. Gunter Falkenhayn, director of a mine that supplied IG Farben's chemicals complex, divided his Ostarbeiter into three classes, concentrating the available food on those workers who provided the best return per unit of calories. Those at the bottom fell into a fatal spiral of malnutrition and underperformance. By 1943, he had received national recognition, and the idea of Leistungsernährung, or performance feeding, was promulgated as standard practice in the employment of Ostarbeiter. No order ever came from above, instructing party members to restrict adequate feeding to above-average workers, but it seemed an effective enough strategy to some cadres keen to obtain maximum output for minimal expense. In Peach Village, Guangdong, the cadres divided the farmers into 12 different grades, calibrated according to performance. Workers in the top grade were given just under 500 grams of grain a day. Those lingering at the bottom received a mere 150 grams a day, a starvation diet that weeded out the most vulnerable elements. They were replaced by others who inexorably slipped down the ranks, edging closer to the end. 1 in 10 was starved to death in 1960. In fact, throughout the country, as we have seen, units were divided into different ranks, red, grey and white flags being handed out to advanced, mediocre and backward units. It was a small step to elaborate the system further and make calorie income dependent on rank. In Xintang County, for instance, one village divided its members into superior, middle and inferior groups, their names respectively listed on red, green or white paper. Members of different ranks were not allowed to mix. Red names were praised, but white names were relentlessly persecuted, many ending up in makeshift labour camps for re-education. Suicide reached epidemic proportions. For every murder, an untold number suffered in one way or another, and some of these opted to end their lives. Often it was not so much the pain that pushed a person to end it all, as the shame and humiliation endured in front of other villagers. A set phrase was that such and such, having strayed from the path, was afraid of punishment and committed suicide. Driven to their deaths, or driven against the wall, were also common expressions used to describe self-murder. In Fengxian, Shanghai, of the 960 people who were killed in the space of a few months in the summer of 1958, 95 were forced into an impasse and committed suicide, while the others died of untreated illnesses, torture, or exhaustion. As a very rough rule of thumb, figures again are woefully unreliable, about 3 to 6% of avoidable deaths were caused by suicide, meaning that between 1 and 3 million people took their lives during the Great Leap Forward. In Puning, Guangdong, suicides were described as ceaseless. Some people ended their lives out of shame for having stolen from fellow villagers. When collective punishment was meted out, those who felt guilty for having endangered others committed suicide. In Kaiping County, a 56-year-old lady pilfered 2 handfuls of grain. Her entire household was banned from the canteen for 5 days and sent to a labor camp. She committed suicide. Sometimes women took their children with them, knowing that they would not survive on their own. In Chantaux, a woman accused of theft tied her two children to her body before jumping into the river. In cities too, suicide rates rocketed, although there are few reliable figures. The Bureau of Public Security in Nanjing, for instance, was alarmed when it reported that in the first half of 1959, some 200 people had jumped into the river to commit suicide. The majority were women. Many killed themselves because their families had been torn apart by collectivization. Tang Guoying, for instance, lost her son to illness. Then her house was destroyed to make way for an irrigation project. She joined her husband, who worked in a Nanjing factory. When the authorities launched a campaign to send villagers back to the countryside, he did nothing to protect her. She hanged herself. Chapter 35. Sights of Horror. The horror of mass destruction was first encountered by the party leadership in Xinjiang. It reduced Li Xianyan, a tough veteran of the Red Army, to tears. The immediate reaction was to blame counter-revolutionaries. Soon a campaign unfolded across the country to take power back from the forces of reaction, often with military backing from the center. But in a clever move designed to portray Xinjiang as an exception, reports were released within the party relating to the Xinjiang incident. To this was added the Fengyang incident, named after a dusty county in a plain by the Huai River in Anhui province. Here too a reign of terror had claimed a quarter of the 335,000 villages. A compilation of party reports on both cases started circulating in the 1980s, including a 600-page document that was smuggled out of China in the wake of the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. These subsequently became the basis for most studies of the period. Xinjiang became a byword for the famine. However, local cadres who convened across the country to discuss the Xinjiang report in 1961 were unimpressed. In Xiangtan, Hunan, a county where tens of thousands had died, some cadres thought that the Xinjiang incident paled in comparison to what had happened in their own backyard. Why should it be called an incident, some wondered. There are, indeed, vast numbers of villages where death claimed more than 30% of the population in a single year. In some cases, entire hamlets were wiped out. But counties are much larger political entities, their populations typically ranging from 120,000 to 350,000. A death rate of 10% in one year across an entire county, composed of many hundreds of villages, some tightly clustered together, others divided by hills, rivers or forests, could have occurred only under immense political pressure. These sites of horror, where deceit and terror combined to produce mass killings, existed across the country. Every province under the leadership of a political zealot had several. Some even boasted a dozen. There is unlikely to be a complete list of such cases any time soon, given that so much of the party archives remains locked away, but below is a provisional list of 56 counties, which will no doubt grow as better sources become available. It is based on a compilation of 40 counties by Wang Weizi, a demographer who worked for the Public Security Bureau in Beijing. But his information is incomplete, as it is derived from official figures sent to the capital rather than on local findings. A number of counties have been added to the list on the basis of the archival material consulted for this book. Several of these cases will be examined in this chapter. Sichuan, Shichui, Yingqing, Fuling, Zhongxian, Dazhou, Jiyang, Xiushan, Youyang, Nanxi, Jianxiang, Lushan, Jianwei, Muchuan, Pingshan, Bixian, Yan, Lushan, Suda. Anhui, Chaoxian, Taihe, Dinghuan, Wuwei, Xuancheng, Huaoxian, Suxian, Fengyang, Fuyang, Feidong, Wuhe, Henan, Guangshan, Changcheng, Xinshai, Zhenan, Tanghe, Xixian, Guxi, Jinyang, Shanxi, Suiping, Gansu, Tongwei, Longxi, Wuwei, Guizhou, Meitan, Jishui, Jinsha, Tongji, Qinghai, Huanzhong, Zaduo, Qinghe, Shandong, Chuyu, Jining, Qihe, Pingyuan, Hunan, Guchang, Guangxi, Huangxiang. Tongwei, in the northwest of Gansu, was one of the poorest areas in the country. Set among undulating hills and divided by ravines on an arid Loess plateau, it was once an important stop on the ancient Silk Road. Before the center of gravity moved away towards the lush south, the region had heaved with human activity, as good use was made of the rich Loess. Signs of the past are everywhere, as the soil is easy to dig. Walls, houses, and mounds for tombs were made of Loess and seemed to be carved straight out of the landscape. Caves were sculpted out of brittle hills, some with arched openings and dusty courtyards. Over time, wind and rain eroded the mountain, and the dwellings ended up standing on their own. Terraces on top of hills and roads through deep valleys blended into a landscape of dirt that was moulded over the ages by busy hands. The Red Army occupied Tongwei in September 1935, where Mao composed an ode to the Long March. Si Daolong, head of the county, was a model party member, selected in May 1958 by the province to attend one of the Communist Party's most prestigious meetings in Beijing. When the chairman's call for radical collectivization came a few months later, Xi responded with zeal, amalgamating all the cooperatives into 14 giant communes. Under the watchful eyes of the militia, everything was collectivized: land, livestock, homes, tools, and even pots, tins, and jars were confiscated. Farmers had to follow every dictate from party leaders. As Tongwei was a key link in the province's plan to divert a tributary of the Yellow River up the mountains to create a water highway which would turn the arid plateau into a green garden, one in five farmers was dispatched to work on a reservoir. In order to please an inspection team sent to spur on work on the irrigation scheme, half of all villagers were dragged out to distant construction sites in the midst of the harvest. The crop was allowed to rot in the fields. In a poverty-stricken county where farmers only just managed to eke out a living, more than 13,000 hectares were abandoned in the first year of the Great Leap Forward alone. Over the years, the harvest shrank, from 82,000 tons in 1957 to 58,000 tons in 1958 to 42,000 in 1959 and finally to a miserable 18,000 tons in 1960. But the procurements increased. Si Daolong reported a bumper harvest of 130,000 tons in 1958. The state took a third. In 1959, Si again reported twice as much. As the state now took almost half, there was hardly any grain left. Villagers who complained were branded rightists, saboteurs, or anti-party agitators. The head of the county, a man called Tian Buxiao, was deeply shaken by what he saw in the countryside. He was denounced as an anti-party element and repeatedly subjected to struggle sessions as a small Peng De Huai. He committed suicide in October 1959. Over 1,000 cadres who objected in one way or another were taken to task. Some were dismissed, others locked up. But torture was also widespread, in particular against villagers. People were buried alive in the caves carved from the lowest hills. In the winter they were buried under the snow. Other forms of torture were used, including bamboo needles. In the unedited report appended to the file containing the final version sent up to the provincial committee, a sentence mentions that people were beaten to death and made into compost. More than 1,300 were beaten or tortured to death. By the winter of 1959-60, people were eating bark, roots and chaff. According to a report compiled by the county committee in Dongwei a few years after the famine, some 60,000 people died in 1959 and 1960. The county had 210,000 villages in 1957. Few households escaped starvation. Almost everyone had several relatives who died of hunger, and more than 2,000 families were entirely wiped out. Si Daolong was eventually arrested, but he could hardly have presided over a reign of terror lasting several years without the support of his superiors. One rung above him stood Dou Minghai, party secretary of the Dingxi region, to which Tongwei belonged. Dou himself was under constant scrutiny from Zhang Zhongliang, the boss in Gansu. So intense was the pressure that he considered villages who tried to escape from the region to be all bad, every one of them guilty of opposing the party. He kept on pressing for higher procurement rates, declaring that, "I would rather that people die of hunger than ask the state for grain." But in the end, even his superiors could no longer ignore the extent of the starvation, and a 100-strong team was sent from the provincial capital, Lanzhou, in February 1960. Si Daolong and his aides were arrested. A month later, a report was sent to Beijing. The central leadership declared Dongwei to be completely rotten. Sichuan, unlike Gansu, is a rich and fertile province traditionally known as the Land of Abundance, with subtropical forests and hundreds of rivers that have been diverted since ancient times for irrigation purposes. But in this huge province the size of France, there are vast variations, with deep valleys and rugged mountains on the western Sichuan Plateau, sparsely populated with ethnic minority people, in contrast to the basin around Chengdu, where low hills and alluvial plains support tens of millions of farmers. More counties in Sichuan than anywhere else had a death rate of over 10% a year. Most were impoverished areas in the mountains around the basin area, but quite a few were scattered around Chongqing, a city clinging higgledy-piggledy to steep cliffs by the Yangtze. This was the case, for instance, with Fuling, a relatively prosperous county with terraced fields along the Yangtze River in the hinterland outside Chongqing. Baozi, a commune of 15,000 people, known as Fuling's grain storage, produced such abundant harvests that it usually sent half of its produce as tribute to the state. Along the main road, up to 400 people could be found on any one day, busy bringing grain, vegetables and pigs to market. But by 1961, grain output had plummeted by some 87%. The fields were overgrown with weeds, and half of the population had vanished. A wind of communism had blown over the commune, as bricks, wood, pots, tools, and even needles and nappies for babies had been confiscated in a mad scramble for collectivization, in which the very notion of individual property was seen as rightist conservatism. "We can eat our fill even without agriculture for 3 years," was the slogan of the day, as 70% of the workforce was diverted away from agriculture towards the building of large canteens, piggeries and markets. People still working in the fields had to follow commands from the commune, for instance tearing out acres of maize because a deputy party secretary thought that the leaves were turned in the wrong direction. Close planting, on the other hand, killed the rice crop on some of the most fertile plots. In parts of the commune, 80% of the rice terraces were converted to dry land for vegetables, with disastrous results. Then, as an order came from Li Jinxuan that advanced units should help turn the mountains into a rich green, with slopes covered with wheat, farmers were made to abandon the fertile terraces to scrape the rocky earth up in the highlands many miles away. To conceal the precipitous decline in agricultural output, in 1959 the commune leaders declared a crop of 11,000 tons instead of the 3,500 tons in storage. The state took 3,000 tons. The militia went around checking for hidden stashes of grain, taking whatever they could get their hands on. Struggle sessions punctuated the daily schedule. Body weight was the class line demarcating the poor from the rich. To be fat was to be a rightist, and rightists were ceaselessly pursued, often to the death. In the end, people had nothing to eat but bark and mud. Up to a third of the population died in some of the villages in Baozi. Baozi was by no means exceptional. Throughout Fuling County, death rates were high, with some villages losing 9% of their people in a single month in 1960. An average death rate of 40 to 50% was not uncommon in brigades across the region. Other counties in the Chongqing area also had death rates of over 10% in 1960. For instance, Shichu, Xiushan, and Yuyang. In Shichu, the militia forbade villages from foraging for roots and wild herbs, searching every home for pots and pans to prevent cooking outside the canteens. Violence was common, as beating squads, Darundui, in parts of the county, took charge of discipline. Some carried pincers and bamboo needles. Chen Jilin, a deputy secretary of one of the communes, beat several hundred people, killing eight. Some were buried alive. In the county as a whole, according to the Public Security Bureau, some 64,000 people died in 1959-60 alone, or 20% of the population. So overwhelmed by waves of death were the authorities that in the end the dead were cast into mass graves. 40 bodies were tossed into a pit in Shuitian commune. Near the road to the county capital, another 60 corpses were buried in a shallow trench, but the job was carried out so badly that 20 of the bodies had parts sticking out of the ground, which were soon attacked by ravenous dogs. As coffin wood was scarce, several dead toddlers at a time were carried out in rattan containers to be buried. Far away from the lush valleys along the Yangtze, pitched battles bloodied the grasslands up in the Tibetan Plateau to the west. In 1959 in Sirtar, Sida, a county in the Gansu Autonomous Region, Tibetans were rounded up and forced into collectives after Lhasa had been rocked by rebellion and the Dalai Lama forced to flee on foot over the Himalayan mountains into India. Dozens of uprisings took place in Gansu by the end of 1958, leading to thousands of arrests and many executions. In Sirtar, widespread slaughter preceded collectivization, since herdsmen preferred to kill their sheep rather than hand them over to the state. Tens of thousands of animals were butchered and eaten. The carders, in control of the grain, refused to feed the nomads, using the militia to extract every possible hint of wealth from those they considered to be their enemies. Corralled into makeshift communes, many people died of disease. Whereas the nomads had had access to clean water all year round, they were now packed into shoddy encampments without adequate facilities, and quickly overrun with excrement and detritus. Out of a population of some 16,000, about 15% died in 1960 alone. About 40% of those who died were beaten or tortured to death. Guizhou, unlike its northern neighbour Sichuan, is an impoverished province, historically rocked by rebellions from the minority people who compose at least a third of the population, many of them living in poverty in the hills and highlands that dominate what is known as the Kingdom of Mountains. Qi Shui, Once prosperous as a strategically located pass for the transportation of salt,